Hello, this is Wendy Bauer. I'm returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated August 3rd, 2015. We will continue now with the obituaries. From today's legal notices, Dora Ann Deluge from Long Creek. Dora Ann Deluge, 77, of Long Creek, Illinois, passed away at 2 a.m. Sunday, Sunday, August 2nd, 2015, in her residence. A service to celebrate Dora's life will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 5th, 2015, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, with Pastor Randall Garrett officiating. Burial will be in Point Pleasant Cemetery, Long Creek. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation beginning at 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday evening at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to St. Jude Children's Hospital. Gerald R. Hawkins, 76, of Venice, Florida, formerly of Decatur, Illinois, died on August 1, 2015. A graveside service will take place on Wednesday, August 5, 2015, at 10 o'clock a.m. at Venice Memorial Gardens. Zelmalia Davis, of Pena. Zelmalia Jones Davis, 87, Pena, died Friday, July 31, 2015. Services will be at 1 p.m. Monday, McCracken Dean Funeral Home in Pena. Visitation will be 1 hour before the services. Burial will be at Price Cemetery, Oconee. Memorials may be made to Prairie Rose Healthcare Activity Fund. E. Irene Floyd. E. Irene Reedy Floyd, of 74, of Neoga, retired teacher's aide, died Thursday, July 30th, 2015. Private family services. Arrangements are being made by Swengel Odell Funeral Home in Neoga. Memorials, donor's choice. Kenneth Wayne Kammeyer of Decatur. Kenneth Wayne Kammeyer, 68, of Enola, died Tuesday, July 28th, 2015. All are welcome to join Ken's family at his viewing on Friday, August 7, 2015, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Myers-Burig Funeral Home and Crematory, and for his celebration of life service on Saturday, August 8, 2015, at 11 o'clock a.m. at Aldersgate United Methodist Church. Maxine Musselman of Decatur. Maxine Musselman, 95, formerly a resident of Rock Springs Road in Decatur, Illinois, died Monday, July 27th at Wesley Willows in Rockford, Illinois. Private memorial service will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to First Presbyterian Church, 204 West Prairie Avenue, Decatur, Illinois, or Barn Colony Artists of Decatur, 125 North Water Street, Decatur, Illinois. Marion D. Power. Marion D. Power, 80, of North Fort Myers, Florida, formerly of Decatur, died July 26, 2015, in Carl Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. Services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, August 5th, Lighthouse Baptist Church in Quincy. Burial will be at the Sunset Cemetery in Quincy. Memorials may be made to the Lighthouse Baptist Church. Charles Earl Pratt of Decatur. Charles Earl Pratt, 82, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 4:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th, in his home. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Monday, August 3rd, at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur. Graveside services will be held at IOOF Cemetery Moequa, Illinois. Gaylord L. Reagan of Shelbyville. Gaylord L. Reagan, 96, of Shelbyville, Illinois, died at 7:25 p.m. Thursday, July 30th, 2015, in Shelbyville Manor. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, August 3rd, in Howe and Yaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville, Illinois. Burial will be in Mount Carmel Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois, with military rites by the Shelby County Honor Guard. Memorials may be given to the Shelby County Honor Guard or the American Cancer Society. Evelyn Rawlings, Long Creek. Evelyn Rawlings, 83, of Long Creek, Illinois, passed away at 6 o'clock p.m. Monday, July 27th, 2015, in Prairie Rose Nursing Home, Pena, Illinois. A service to celebrate Evelyn's life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 15th, 2015, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion. Interment will follow at Point Pleasant Cemetery, Long Creek. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation beginning at 10 a.m. Saturday morning until service time. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Foundation. Hazel Louise Utzler, Shelbyville. Hazel Louise Utzler, 68, of Shelbyville, Illinois, died at 3:10 a.m. Friday, July 31st, 2015, in St. John's Hospital, Springfield, Illinois. A memorial service will be held at a later date, now scheduled for Monday, August 17th, 2015, at 11 a.m. in Howe and Yaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville. Casual attire is requested. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, August 17th, 2015. Burial will be in Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois. Memorials may be given to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital or Saving Orphaned Animals. And now from the editorial page, inmate population moves down. The prison population in Illinois is declining, which is good news for everyone connected with the state's correctional system, including taxpayers. Because of policies already in place, the population of men and women in the Illinois Department of Corrections has dropped to a level not seen in 5 years. The 3.7% decrease has brought the number of inmates to 47,483, according to the May count. That's the lowest number since May 2010, when the department reported 47,150 inmates. After the 2010 report, the number of inmates skyrocketed, especially after then-Governor Pat Quinn had to shut down a controversial prisoner early release program. That early release program resulted in thousands of inmates with convictions for drunken driving and weapons violations released after spending just weeks behind bars. It took the Quinn administration nearly 2 years to establish a new prisoner release program, and the number of inmates peaked at 49,321 in January of 2013. The recent drop in inmates is due to the success of the new program, which focuses on moving inmates out of the system if they are nonviolent and have exhibited good behavior. Through May, that program has released 2,114 inmates. But the drop in inmates is also due to a slowing of the number of new inmates entering the system. In 2009, the Corrections Department processed 27,400 new inmates. In the most recent fiscal year, that number has dropped to 19,600. McLean County has reduced the number of inmates entering the state prison system from 462 to 274 during the same period, and the Macon County numbers have dropped from 626 to 474. That doesn't mean that more criminals are wandering the streets, however. Every judicial district has set up programs for alternative sentencing, most notably drug courts. Drug courts divert offenders from prison and into treatment programs. To be eligible, a defendant must be substance-dependent and charged with a nonviolent felony. The treatment option not only achieves a better outcome for the defendant, but also saves money when compared to the cost of incarceration. Despite the progress, the prison system is still considered overcrowded. The system is designed for a population of about 32,000. Governor Bruce Rauner has appointed a special commission to look at reducing the prison population by 25% over the next 10 years. It's important that such programs balance the need to decrease the prison population with the public safety. However, alternative sentencing, educational opportunities within prison, and other early release programs have proven to be successful. The good news is the state is already making progress toward Rauner's goal. And thumbs up, thumbs down. Thumbs up to the first big obstacle 3K, which was held in Fairview Park on Saturday. The tough race, made even tougher by hot, humid conditions, attracted about 250 participants and was presented by the National Guard as a fundraiser for the United Way of Decatur and Mid-Illinois and the Decatur Park District. Participants had to overcome 23 different obstacles over the 3-kilometer course. Thumbs up to the Spirit of Silas Memorial Ride, which raised money and remembered Silas Martin, 16, who died December 23rd after dealing with severe medical problems, including cancer. The events took up the entire weekend and included bands and refreshments at Woody's Bar, a motorcycle run, and a special dance that was taped. That video will be sent to Ellen DeGeneres, who has awarded prizes up to $50,000 for touching videos associated with good causes. Thumbs up to Hall of Fame pitcher John Smoltz, who warned parents and coaches that baseball is not a year-round sport. During his acceptance speech to the Hall of Fame, Smoltz encouraged young players to participate in other sports and to decrease the amount of competitive baseball they play. The result, he said, is that too many young pitchers are having arm surgery too early in their careers. Smoltz's words apply to all sports. There are too many parents pushing youngsters into highly competitive situations at too young of an age. Thumbs up to a new law that should bring an end to the practice of doling out welfare benefits to dead people. The law, approved by the General Assembly and signed by Governor Bruce Rauner, requires the Illinois Department of Human Services to do a monthly review of state death records to determine if any of the deceased are still receiving aid. The legislation was approved after two audits showed millions of taxpayer dollars had been paid to people who are dead. It's important that the new law was approved, although it seems odd there is a need for a law to do something so obvious. Thumbs up to the Lincoln Square Theater's Board of Directors for doing what they can to keep the 99-year-old theater operating. The board has managed to get the theater, which was up for sale just a few months ago, on firmer financial ground and have started to schedule some events in the theater. It's a struggle, however, as the board tries to find the type of entertainment that will attract a substantial number of paying customers. The theater has proven to be a survivor, and it will be interesting to see how the latest efforts pay off. Written by Gary Sawyer, contest will honor Past of Decatur. A Decatur claim to fame is that the community is the home of the original Staley Bears, the pro football franchise that became the Chicago Bears. That heritage is being celebrated this month with the release of a special Decatur Staley's Miller Lite can. The Herald and Review is helping with this celebration by sponsoring a contest, Decatur Staley's Fan of the Can. To enter the contest is simple. Submit a photo of yourself with the commemorative can to our website. Then vote for your favorite photo and get your friends to do the same. The winner of the contest will receive two tickets to the Chicago Bears versus Oakland Raiders game on October 4th, plus overnight accommodations. The contest and voting begins tomorrow and continues until Monday, August 17th. Each person can vote online up to 20 times per day. The formation of the Decatur Staleys and their migration to Chicago is a story worth repeating. Much of the information can be gleaned from the website maintained by the Staley Museum. A.E. Staley, of course, was the founder of the company bearing his name, and by 1919 had built a well-established business. He also formed athletic programs for his employees, both as participants and spectators. He also probably believed the athletic teams would help promote the Staley name. In 1919, the Staleys were a team of employees, but competition was growing more ferocious, and companies in surrounding communities and across the Midwest were recruiting players to play for their teams. Staley, always competitive, hired George Halas to coach the company football team. He also hired Hall of Fame baseball player Joe Iron Man McGinnity to coach the company's baseball team. Halas recruited players to the team by guaranteeing them a job with the Staley Company. Each team member was allowed to practice as part of the work week, and the players also received a portion of the admissions. In September 1920, Halas met with several other football teams in Akron, Ohio, and in 2 hours formed what would become the American Professional Football Association, the forerunner of the National Football League. One of the driving forces behind the formation of the league was to adopt a single set of rules for the game. The Decatur Staleys had a 10-1-2 record that first year and claimed to be champions of the league. However, at a league meeting in April 1921, the team from Akron was given the championship. Staley soon recognized, however, that maintaining a football team in the smaller city of Decatur would be a challenge. He encouraged Halas to move the team to Chicago. The team retained the Staley name for 1 year, and the Staley Company continued to employ the players and paid the team $5,000 to complete the move. Before the 1922 season, the team adopted the name Bears as a bigger, more fierce companion to the baseball Chicago Cubs. The team played its games in Wrigley Field, the home of the Cubs. The rest, as they say, is history. Halas went on to be one of the pioneers of the NFL. The Staley presence is still felt in Decatur, although the plant is now owned and operated by Tate and Lyle. And you can be a small part of that history by participating in our Decatur Staley's Fan of the Can contest. And from Marnie Jameson of the Decatur Herald and Review, dog beds for the discerning designer. Starting with a picture of an adorable dog looking very comfortable on a large pillow dog bed, captioned, "This cotton dandy pillow bed from Jacks and Bones is ideal for sprawlers, dogs that like to sleep stretched out." Mom always said you don't just marry the man, you marry his whole family. In the case of DC, that meant he and Peapod were a package deal. DC rescued Peapod from a shelter 5 years ago. A Heinz 57 mix with a healthy dollop of rat terrier, Peapod had just had 6 puppies, which were all adopted, leaving her behind, homeless and facing an uncertain future. For good reason, she adores him. She can hear his car coming from 3 blocks away, and when he's not home, she rests her head on his shoes. Slowly, with the help of cheese snacks and belly rubs, she's accepted me into the pack, too. But when I suggested that Peapod get a new bed before she and DC moved into the new happy yellow house, the fur flew. Now, you need to understand, this bed was a dirty pillow pillow the size of a pool raft covered in matted polyester lambskin, surrounded on 2 sides by a bolster of tired rust brocade that hadn't been fashionable since the Backstreet Boys were in the top 40. "She loves her bed," said DC. "And she will love her new bed," I said. "But I don't want her to go through too many changes at once. Moving to a new house will already be hard on her." "But the bed is a biohazard. We need to wear hazmat gear just to move it." "Hear that, Peapod? Marnie thinks your bed is a pigsty." Peapod was listening intently. Her brown eyebrows, like quotation marks, were raised in concern. The white margins of her eyes grew wider at the edges. "Okay," I said. "How about if we get the new bed, but keep it next to the old one until she gets used to it?" DC and Peapod reluctantly agreed. Though I sweat most home design decisions, this one caused my stomach to tie into a knot like a rawhide chew. I needed for Peapod to love her new bed and for it to look as divine as a dog bed can in a home. For reinforcement, I called my friend Missy Tannen, the dog lover and bedding diva who founded Bowl and Branch, a new bed linen company that has been growing faster than bamboo. "Don't we just love to spoil our pups rotten," said Missy, "but we can't let their beds take away from a beautifully decorated room." "Exactly," I said. We compared dog notes. Three of her dog beds came from Orvis, that American institution that caters to the outdoorsy set. Though the company tends toward conservative solids and plaids, they offer a few fun patterns. Her fourth bed is from Bowsers, a Canadian company that offers a funkier novel selection and is known for donut-style beds. "I'm now eyeing one from Jack's and Bones for my family room," she said. After surfing around, I bought a sofa bed from Grandin Road because it came in the perfect color for the master bedroom. Spa, a pale, watery blue, micro suede. I also liked that the cover was removable and washable. For the family room, I ordered a Milan orange lounge bed on the way from Jack's and Bones. When the spa-colored bed arrived, we tucked Peapod's favorite toy inside. She hopped in, curled up, and hasn't looked back. The old bed was swiftly retired. Peapod and I, we are going to get along just fine. I asked Jessica Pope, Director of Sales and Marketing for Jack's and Bones, for tips on how to pick a bed a dog will love. "Style. Consider your dog's sleep style when picking a bed style," she said. "Sprawlers like pillow beds, while curlers prefer a nest style or a bed with a bolster. Super snugglers do well in a donut style. Owners of older dogs often look for orthopedic extras like memory foam mattresses. Tufted beds also offer more support. Be sure to get the fit right. Check the fabric. Whether your pup drools or sheds will impact the fabric choice. Most dog beds are made of durable, washable fabric and have removable covers. Decor. You'll find dozens of colors and patterns to pick from. Besides choosing a fabric that coordinates with your home, consider picking one that has the color of your dog's fur. Pope sells more blue and green beds than any other color, although orange has been surprisingly popular. And an article out of Charleston by Dave Fope, a Lee News Service writer. Charleston man makes whirligigs for pure whimsy. Picture captioned, "Gary Foster demonstrates one of the whirligigs at the home of Dick and Kathy Hummel near Charleston." Honest Abe chops some wood outside a log cabin. A whale hunter jabs away with a harpoon while on the back of his target. Wood, wire, and wind combine to set them in motion. They're called whirligigs, and Gary Foster says they're just for pure whimsy. Foster started making them about 30 years ago, and now uses his remaining collection to help people learn more about them. Figures such as Abe Lincoln, a sailor, and others are cut from wood, then joined with a propeller and some sort of rudder attached to the base. Wire and small moving parts work with the propeller so the whirligigs turn in the wind. Much of the whimsy comes from the design and how the figures are painted, and Foster said he likes how he was able to put different faces on the various sailor figures he's made. Foster went from carving things such as spoons and bowls in the 1970s to being introduced to furniture making about 10 years later. Then it was a combination of his earlier woodworking, seeing and enjoying others' whirligigs, and an interest from his career in academics that helped lead him to making them himself. Foster is the former chairman of the Anthropology and Sociology Department at Eastern Illinois University. He said he was working on his master's degree in folklore at Western Kentucky University when he met a man who had a whirligig on a fence post. "I started thinking about whirligigs," he said. Then, credit goes to friend Dick Hummel, who got Foster involved in furniture making and opened up the workshop at his rural Charleston home for Foster to use. "I provided the space," Hummel said. Foster said his first whirligig was an Uncle Sam figure he made about 30 years ago. He wanted it to be functional and move with the wind, but said it ended up being more of a learn-by-doing experience. "I got absolutely everything wrong," he said, explaining that he started thinking about the physics behind the figures, realizing there had to be propeller and a rudder for the whirligig to move. "I figured it out myself," Foster said. "There's not much in the way of whirligig instruction." About a half dozen of the 16 or so whirligigs Foster made are at the home of Hummel and his wife, Kathy, including the one depicting Lincoln chopping wood that he made about 15 years ago. The Hummels bought it after Foster donated it to an auction to raise money for the Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center Hospice Program. "I just wanted to do something that had an Illinois theme," Foster said. Otherwise, many of the remaining whirligigs are of sailors or of something related to sailing, which Foster called the most satisfying. "They all seem to have a connection to the water," he said. "I have a fascination with the sea." There's a series of Sailor Jack whirligigs that include a pirate with an eye patch, a gold tooth, and a parrot on his shoulder. Foster said you can add to the whimsy, which features such as a slingshot in one sailor's back pocket. One future whirligig in Foster's plans is another sailor, an African-American with which he said he wants to acknowledge the maritime history, the early history of the United States. Foster said he starts by sketching his idea for a whirligig on paper, then thinks about the mechanics needed to make it move in the wind. He usually uses pine for the figure itself, but a variety of items for the base. Each base is related to its whirligig's subject, such as whalebone for the harpooner, a boat propeller for the sailors, and a piece of wood from a Kentucky log cabin for the Lincoln figure. Painting the whirligig takes some thinking about how it might look if it sat on a fence post for years and years, as old-time whirligigs did. "I try to imagine if this whirligig were outside and left to the elements," Foster said, "how would it wear? I think that's part of the art." Whirligigs from the 19th century and older were for entertainment, especially for the people who made them, Foster said. They were meant to be left outside, so they were pretty much neglected, and that's why not many early ones are still around, he said. And this has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, August 3rd, 2015. I look forward to reading with you again sometime soon.